Good morning. I have a PowerPoint for you, but the room doesn't have a connection to connect my laptop. So if and when it comes, then you may be able to see so that you can join. I'm talking about thriving in diaspora, and because I'm not from around here, I usually put a PowerPoint so that people can connect what I'm saying to what they're seeing, because I speak with an accent. Anyway, the plan today is to talk about thriving in diaspora. The first question I have for you is, what do you think when you hear of the word thriving? It's a real question. Prosper. What else?
Abundance.
Maximize potential.
Health.
What else?
Exuberance.
So usually when we think about thriving, prosper, health, but it also implies difficulties. Yes? To progress towards a goal despite circumstances, or sometimes because of those circumstances, right? So thriving. What do we think about diaspora? What does diaspora convey? Displaced, scattered, exile. So that explains then our talk today. Thriving in diaspora, addressing the challenges of a leader in a displaced context. When we read the Bible, that we find sometimes when you think about diaspora, it's not just the idea of being away from home, not at home. And that diaspora can also be a situation where it's not that you're not at home, but that the reality of how you live at home causes you to be put to the margins. Make sense? So that when we think of diaspora, it can be both a physical, political, geographical reality, but it can also be a theological situation. And we'll talk about that as we talk some more. So we thriving in diaspora, the challenges and opportunities that we face in a displaced context, and as a leader, how do we deal with that? I want to call your attention to something that we talk about as the tale of righteous sufferers. The tale of righteous sufferers. As you read the Old Testament and also the New Testament, but primarily the Old Testament, you find that there's kind of a setting where the children of Israel always find themselves somewhere in a displaced context where their leaders have to suffer because of the stands they take for God. They are called Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Esther. You look at Isaiah's description of the servant of Yahweh. All of these people find themselves in exile or in a displaced context and in diaspora. And because of the decision they make to live for God, which kind of goes against the grain of the popular culture, if you'll call it, these people then find themselves in a difficult situation. Jesus, though he was at home, is going to find himself in the same situation. Why? Because he brings a message that's different. He carries a lifestyle that's different from what was expected. And it cost him his life eventually. So then when we look at the lives of these people, we can begin to learn from them how a leader can thrive in diaspora. Because the Bible has many examples of how leaders have found themselves in diaspora, either because they're really in exile or because they're at home, but the way they choose to live at home causes them to encounter numerous difficulties of different kinds. Israel in Egypt or Israel in Babylon, as a nation, experience similar reality, so that, as I mentioned earlier, diaspora in and of itself is not just a physical geographical thing. Diaspora is a theological reality. So if you remember Wednesday night, the first night, when Brother Ephraim talked about both 1 John, the idea, when you read in the Gospel of John, Jesus is saying, you are of the world, but you're in the world, but you're not of the world. We are here, but we are not. We are home, but not at home. Why? Because there's something that has happened in us that kind of moves us in a different reality. So, because we now belong to a different kind of world, it creates a displacement. So when you hear displaced context, we need to think both in terms of some of us who are no longer home because we are from a different country, from a different place, but also what does it mean for us to be children of God living in a world that's going away from what God asks and the way he expects us to live. So the next question I have for you then is, and just think about 30 seconds or a minute to think about it, what kind of challenges do you face as a leader in diaspora? What kind of challenges do you face as a leader in diaspora? Feeling alone? What else?
Losing some friends.
Losing some friends because of
theology.
Different theologies, different the way we approach life, right? What else? What are some challenges? Very good, very good. Yes. Yes. I hear something else around here.
Conflict.
What else?
Restless.
Being misunderstood. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Gender bias. Gender and ethnicity. Yes, the challenges that we face. There's a way in which, if we categorize the things we've just talked about, right, we've got both pressures from the outside, many of the things we've talked about, in terms of conflicts, these are outside pressures, right? Our friends leaving us, outside pressures, being misunderstood. All of these are some of those challenges that we face, but there are also some pressures that we face from within, as a result of the challenges we face in diaspora. Because our friends are leaving us, we want to perhaps compromise. Right? Because we're on the margins, sometimes we may envy other people's position or situation. These are inside, inward pressures that may cause us to do certain things or to live a certain way in order to manage what it feels to be in diaspora, right? So those challenges can be coming both from inside and from outside. So James 1, 2 to 17, 1 Peter 1, 3 to 9, kind of sets up those two realities. James 1, 2 to 17, 1 Peter 1, 3 to 9, 1 Peter deals primarily with the challenges that are brought from the outside. We've named them already. Friends that misunderstand us, family that leave us or force us to leave them, co-workers. And Peter will also even state the enemy. We can't forget about, Satan and his role in creating systems and situations that cause us to face discomfort. James, on the other hand, focuses on the trials and the challenges that come from within. Because James will then talk about our own desires leading us and creating a context of temptation that creates a situation that poses challenges. And James will talk about our desires when we lured and enticed, and then when they conceive, create sin, which then when sin is fully grown in terms of the things that we do, that leads to death. You've got kind of that step into those challenges that he talks about. So then our conversation today is about addressing both the challenges and the opportunities, right? Because the challenges in and of themselves create the opportunities to be the kind of people God wants us to be. So the question for me then for you is, when we think about, you know, Daniel and his friends, Esther, people like Ezra and Nehemiah, or the exiles in Babylon, I assume you know these stories, right? So what comes to mind? What can we learn? What can we learn about them and from them? Okay? What can we learn about them and from them in terms of their ability to thrive in diaspora? Think about it again for another minute. What can we learn about and from the leaders who thrive in diaspora? And then we can share those with one another. They were obedient to God. What? They have a tenacity of faith. Yes. Exactly. Focus, right? Focus and obedience. Yes, because the wife disobeyed and that's what happened. What else? What? They knew who they were. Their identity were rooted and they knew exactly who they were. In the case of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it's funny that we actually know them by the Babylonian name, but we know them because in spite of their Babylonian name, they were able to maintain their identity as children of Israel. Right? They got there and they changed their name, took them from, you know, Azaliel, Daniel, and others. They give them those, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The worshiper of Nego, but the worshiper of Nego is saying, I'm going to worship Yahweh. He can deliver me. And even if he chooses not to, I'm not worshiping Nego. Their identity, they know their identity, and that was rooted. Some of the things you've mentioned already, they embrace their reality. And we talked about tenacity. I can also use the word resiliency. How should I pronounce that? My wife is like, you didn't pronounce that properly. You didn't put the accent on the right syllable. Resiliency. They built resiliency. Jeremiah 29:4-7. There's at least one place we need to stop and read together. Jeremiah 29:4-7. The Lord of the heavenly forces, the God of Israel, proclaims to the exiles, I have carried off from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Cultivate gardens and eat what they produce. Get married and have children. Then help your sons find wives and your daughters find husbands in order that they too may have children. Increase in number so that you don't dwindle away. Now, in the context of exile, they killed off most of the men. Right? Those that they didn't kill, They kept the cream of the crop and put them in high position. It means that there's a possibility that for them to carry out this, to obey this, it may mean that they may have to find a Babylonian or, you know, an Assyrian wife or husband. this kind of goes against what God is saying. Sleeping with the enemy. The enemy who, by the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down and there we wept when we remember Zion, because they took our babies and split their heads on a rock. And God is saying, seek the welfare of that city? Are you kidding me? But that's what it means. He's saying, build resiliency because I have carried you there. But here's why. Promote the welfare where I have sent you. Pray the Lord for it. Because your future depends on its welfare. For the time being, your future depends on it. So I want you to pray for its welfare. Here's why these verses are important, and that's why I stopped to read it. You go down to verse 10 and 11. The Lord proclaims, when Babylon's 70 years are up, I will come and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. They're plans for peace, not disaster, to give you a future filled with hope. Now, verse 11 is all of us' favorite verse. I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and to keep you and give you a future. We tend to forget the context of it. We tend to forget the context of it. Plan to prosper you because you've built resiliency and obedience when things were really, really hard. In a context where if you obey what I have told you in Deuteronomy, you're going to disobey me now. But you choose to obey me now because that's what I'm saying right now for you to do. Why? Because the same God who puts you in the displaced context is the same God that if you obey while you're facing difficulties in diaspora, can also offer you opportunities to take you out and give you a future that's bigger, better, and better. Addressing the challenges and opportunities in diaspora. Embrace the reality and build resiliency. We've talked about obey already, right? Obey God in the difficult context. Esther. God's name is not mentioned there at all, right? Yet, he's in the background doing everything. And you can hear the uncle saying, Esther, you've got to do something. Who knows? If that's why God has brought you here. And for her to say, you know what? All right. I'm going to do this. If I die, then I die. So when we talk about the tale of righteous sufferers, in terms of obedience, they obey because they know they serve a God who is able to deliver them. Deliver them beyond death. The God we serve can deliver us, and even if he chooses not to, we won't, because they know it's not just about the preservation of this life. It's because he's a God who can actually raise people from the dead. And Ezekiel had that vision already. The children of Israel already had this vision of a God who can deliver beyond death. So if we die, we die, but we're going to obey. Now, this is easier said than done. This is easier said than done, but that's really where the rubber meets the road. If we want to thrive in diaspora, we need to adopt a way of life that really demonstrates our ability to face challenges in certain way, because we know we serve a God who may choose to keep us alive, but for in his wisdom may actually get better glory in our death. I mean, that's what it is. But what he does And his ability to deliver us beyond death is something that then allows us to obey him. And then that then allows us to depend on him and on his ability to not just protect us, but provide for us and deliver us. So then the challenges that we face, yeah, build resiliency, but these are also opportunities for growth. The challenges we face in diaspora are opportunities for growth. If we go back to James, James talks about the trials, the testings of your faith produce endurance, and then endurance produce maturity, completeness, and perfection. Remember earlier, right? He talks about your desires. When you dwell on those desires, they can produce temptation. Then if you act on them, it produces sin. Yes? Now he comes the other way. Trials can produce endurance, which then can produce perfection. So there's a way in which the challenges we face are neutral. How we handle them is what's going to create the outcome, good or bad. Yes? And then when we look at the people that have gone before, the one thing that really sets them apart is their steadfastness, their endurance. It's not the challenge you face, it's how you deal with it. It's how you deal with it. And what we have in front of us is a cloud of witness who, times and times again, dealt with it in a certain way. And if we can look at the examples of how they lived, and we choose to embody that way of life, God can do for us what he's done for them. Break the mold. Show up in the fire. He could have prevented them from being thrown in it. He didn't. But he showed up in the fire and walked alongside them. Though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Not because evil is not present, not because death is not lurking, but because you are with me. That's what makes a difference. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. That's what makes a difference. So understanding that and living that way, approaching things this way, then creates a chance for growth. Therefore, I propose then, I mean, the main things we can talk about, that holy living, right? If we're thinking about steadfastness produces perfection, what James is talking about there is about holiness, holy living. You get to 1 Peter, same thing happens. In terms of holy living becomes an appropriate response to the challenges of diaspora. And I'm saying that not simply because we're in a Wesleyan gathering. That's what the Bible presents. 1 Peter 1, 13 to 17, he says to them, therefore, once you have your minds ready for action and you're thinking clearly, place your hope completely on the grace that will be brought to you when Jesus is revealed. Don't be conformed to your former desires, those that shape you when you were ignorant, but as obedient children, you must be holy in every aspect of your lives. For as the one who called you is holy, it is written, you will be holy because I am holy. Identity. We're embodying the identity of the one who calls us. But that starts, in terms of the call to holy living, begins already in the beginning of the chapter, in the beginning of the letter, where Peter, from chapter 3 to 9, talks about, blessed be the God of our Father, Jesus Christ, who in his great loving kindness has given us new birth into a new inheritance that cannot be defiled. So then there's a way in which I've talked earlier about the changes that happened, right? Why is it that we're facing challenges in diaspora. How can we thrive in diaspora? God as Father, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. To call God Father has implications. As Father, He provides, He protects, He vindicates. The role of a father is to actually not just defend you, but if things went bad, the father is responsible to come and vindicate your cause. So if indeed we serve a God who can vindicate our cause, to acknowledge His fatherhood is to willfully choose to let Him take care of it for us. What does it mean for us to stop, going back to Wednesday night, to stop and say, I'm going to let my father take care of this. Not in a vindictive way. My father is going to take care of you. My father can take care of me. I could do this on my own, but I have somebody who can do that for me. As a father, that's his role. New birth has implications. I used to be this kind of person. Now I am no longer. We are now living in the family of God. What does it mean to live as a child of God? And I'm going to leave it right here. Not as a child of God in an American, as a child of God or in Haitian. As a child of God, full stop. That's the displaced context. Our nationality doesn't define us. Our electoral card doesn't define us. Our identity as a child of God should define who we are and how we live. Then it changes everything. But that's exactly why there's going to be challenges. Your family is going to, the tension at the dinner table at Thanksgiving is going to be high. Depending on what side you take on the political discussions. But what guides your choice? Is it how you vote? But is it how God asks you to live? New birth. You are a child of God. See, when you look at the Old Testament, in the Exodus, when the children of Israel were getting ready to leave Egypt, God told Moses to tell them, you need to eat the Passover with your loins girded. Meaning, because they were getting ready to go really, really fast, they wear long robes. So when you need to walk really fast, you roll up your sleeves, but you roll up your robe and you tie it, you gird it, because you need to go really, really fast. So Peter takes that imagery and says, literally, gird the loins of your mind. So it's translated, get ready for action. Start thinking properly because you're a new kind of person. So to see, to thrive in diaspora and to find yourself in diaspora takes a shift of worldview. New way of thinking, new way of living. That may cause you problems. But because you serve a God who can deliver, you serve a God who has a power to come and be with you, then it's okay. Even if it's difficult. Because that's who He is and that's what He does. Discipline yourself, He says. In the context of the discipline here, right? The language of discipline, as you see both in Paul, in James, and in Peter, is the idea, they use the language of sobriety. Why? Because wine was so popular then that self-control was demonstrated by your ability to know how much to drink and stop without getting tipsy. As Wesleyan will go the other way, just don't touch it at all. Because we perhaps cannot control ourselves. I don't know. I've never asked that question. There you go. How much is enough? That's why you read through, they talk about drunkenness so much. So self-control was to be able to know how to drink and not get drunk. Because that was commonplace at the table. Discipline yourself and set your hope on when Jesus is revealed. Because you see, the revelation of Jesus Christ sets life in diaspora in its proper context. Not just because, oh, he's going to come in and the troubles are going to be gone, but because since he is coming, and we know that for sure, that knowledge is going to define how I live today. You understand the distinction? I'm going to bear it because it's going to end someday. No. He's going to come. Then I need to represent him well today. So that when he does show up, he can say, come, good and faithful servant. You've done well. It changes the way we live. It changes why we do what we do. Because the life of holiness is a life of witness. Because Peter will tell them, live in such a way among those who do not know him, so that when they see your good deeds and glorify him when he comes, they will glorify him because they see your way of life and find it inviting enough that they too choose to live this way. It puts it in perspective. So the call to holiness is rooted in who God is. We've talked about that. It's rooted in who we are. We've talked about that. Who we are, who we have become as his children, and who we are becoming. Because it's a process. It's a process. We learn to live with him. We learn to live for him. So the call to holiness then, if we're talking about thriving diaspora, a leader in a displaced context, listen to me very carefully. The call to holiness is about transformation, not a change of location. Transformation, not a change of location. Because again, it's not about whether I'm a Haitian living in the States, whether I'm somebody from Georgia living in Maine. It's about a child of God living as a child of God, wherever he places us. Then how do we then go through the transformation that allows us to be faithful and steadfast in a way that allows him to show up and deliver us the same way he has done and continue to do and can continue to do? So then holy living is the best response to life and challenges of diaspora. Allow me to just use one example. Our time is finishing. In terms of what are some of the things in terms of practical ways we can demonstrate that. So we'll use controlled speech language as a test case. In Matthew 12, Jesus Matthew 12, 36, 37, Jesus puts a lot of emphasis on speech, the way you use speech. Because he says, your speech is what's going to judge you, your speech is what's going to condemn you or also save you. Right? And we see him putting a lot of emphasis on that. So that there's a way in which controlled speech is really tightly connected to the spiritual transformation that's necessary as we face the challenges the challenges of diaspora. When we read in James, if we go back to James, we find that speech is a vehicle for inappropriate action. Speech can be a vehicle for inappropriate actions. James 2 verse 3, when he talks about favoritism, it is through speech that people show favoritism. When people come to church, you say to them, sit here, or say to them, sit there. So you're judging and putting, but you use language to demonstrate, to do that. James 2 verse 3. False religion is also through speech. If a brother shows up and they are in need and you say to them, hi, how are you today? It's good to see you at church. We'll see you next week. And you know that they're going home hungry and you have a means to care for them and you do nothing. And James says, this is no religion. Religion that is pure, he goes, and undefiled is to care for the orphans and the widows in their troubles. Right? Vehicle for inappropriate action. Boasting, right? I'm going to say, you're going to say, today I'm going to build this, I'm going to build that, tomorrow I'm going to do this. So boasting, again, is done through language. Disputes and conflicts, chapter 4, 1 to 3 in James. Gossip and malicious talk, chapter 4, 11 to 12. So the point here is that through speech, you can destroy one another. Yes? Speech is a vehicle for inappropriate action. But speech also, in this context, controlled speech, is the appropriate response to the challenges of diaspora. James 5, 7 to 11. Even in terms of righteousness, those who can control their speech, he says, if you can control your tongue, you've done it. You've reached perfection. And what he is saying here is that those who've reached consistency in speech, because you see, speech is action. What you say is what you do. What you say is who you are, because your language, what you utter, is an expression of something that's much deeper. So from that standpoint, if what you say can actually really match what you do, then you've gotten there. But again, those actions are then intended to be the kind of actions that God wants us to do, because you've learned to live how He wants you to live. Are you with me? Indeed, right? And in a world where we can hide behind the screen and now say everything we want because there's no face-to-face screen, what does it mean to be a leader in a displaced context who knows how to control speech? Control your language so that what you do match what you say, and what you say is an exact replica of what you think and who you are. Control speech shows our dependence on God, because there are times when you could have responded and then you choose not to say anything. It's one of the marks of a holy life. In 1 Peter, he says to the congregation, just be silent. Let your life dictate what happens. And you'll say, oh, he was talking to the wives there, but he actually talks the same to everyone. But it's not just about being silent, but later on in 3:15, he says, be ready to give an account of anyone who asks. So it's not just about being silent or being verbal. It's knowing the difference on when to be silent, when to say something. Right? But it's dependence on God, because Jesus is the perfect example. When you read in 1 Peter 2:25-27, he says, follow in his footsteps, because when he was abused, he did not speak back. When he was mistreated, he did not threaten. All of these are spoken words, right? But he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He controlled his speech because he depended on God's ability to deliver him. You could say that Jesus is the leader par excellence, right? In diaspora. So then, in a way, persistent faithfulness, vigilance, imitating Christ, love for one another, can be a very courageous stance in how we live in diaspora. Because those who trust him, those who know who they are, I said it earlier, that call is both in who God is, it is in who we are, it is in who we are becoming. And to address and face those challenges that we face in diaspora, knowing who we are and allowing that to reflect the God we serve is going to be the best way to do that. Questions? If you don't have questions for me, I'm going to have questions for you. So here are two questions I want you to think about. And that's for you to take with you. What would it take? What do we need to do or change to thrive in diaspora? So as a leader in diaspora, what would it take? What do we need to do, we could say, what do we need to be or become to thrive in diaspora? That's question one. Question two, what can we do to help our congregations or our families or our children face a world where they may face challenges both from within and from without? So in other words, how do we prepare our congregations to face this world? Either way you cut it, your congregation, your children, our children are growing up in a world that's divided, that's polarized. How do we teach them to manage and navigate a world where, if they truly choose to live for God, it's going to cost them something? It's going to cost them something. How do we help them do that? That's all, folks.